I went to a drug policy reform coordinating group of King County meeting. It's a long name for a meeting, we know. And this guy showed up, someone I'd never seen before. And everything he said was so on point, and he was so smart. And he seemed to have just come out of the ether. I thought, wow, who is this guy? And it wasn't until I read through a little bit of what he's doing and what he's done that it started to make sense. He's a fourth-year MD and PhD at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle. And he's an active member of the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. He's a member of their board. Please welcome Sunil Agarwal.
Hello. I'm actually a student. I want to correct Dominic. So it's really an honor to be here, to be a member of this panel. Thank you for inviting me. You all are my inspiration and my teachers, many of the people here, and have really made it possible for me to speak. It gives me a sense of safety. And the folks in Seattle, for sure, have created an environment of safety and acceptability around marijuana issues. What I'm going to talk to you a little bit about is something that a wise person once said, let your life be your argument. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I'm doing and how I got there and the people along the way who've helped to show me the wisdom. So I'm originally an Okie from Muskogee, born and raised. As you all might remember, that's the famous Merle Haggard song, which was a reaction to the 60s counterculture that Vivian was talking about. And where I grew up, marijuana was a bad word. I mean, a very, very bad word, a stigma through and through. And it wasn't until many years after I left Muskogee, when I came to University of California, Berkeley, across the bay here, that I learned what a complete fabrication and lie that had all been what was taught to me about that. So I have to give props to the Bay Area right away for teaching this Okie from Muskogee that marijuana is not this horrible, horrible thing, which is what we were taught in school. And we sang that song in school, too. We're so proud of it. So it was actually at a Students for Sensible Drug Policy meeting at UC Berkeley in 2001. What DARE didn't teach you, that was what was put on by Scarlett Sweaterlow when she was a student there. She's now nationally involved with Students for Sensible Drug Policy, where I started to realize, oh, wow, there's a lot here. I had no idea. And I met Fred Gardner then too. Fred Gardner is a former editor or advisory board member of the Scientific American, and he writes O'Shaughnessy's, which is the journal for the Clinical Cannabis Physicians Group here in California. And he told me, I was on my way to going to med school then, and he's like, Sunil, you know, you just have to go there and tell your professors to put this in the curriculum, to teach them that this is real medicine, this is real. And so that's really where it all started here. And so I guess what in Seattle I play a couple of roles. One is as a medical student, as a healthcare worker in training. Another role as a scholar, a student. I'm working on my PhD in the geography department. And a third role as an activist in the community with the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility for the last couple of years. We are an organization that really wants to help create a healthy, peaceful, and sustainable world. Very simple. And we believe in nuclear nonproliferation. We believe in cleaning up toxins from our environment, the right kind of chemicals. We believe in promoting nonviolent solutions and a nonviolent energy policy is what our major focus is these days. And since I've been the president of the organization for the last 2 years, we signed on to Roger Goodman's the King County Bar Association's drug policy project. We are a member of the Grass Tops groups that want to see change at drug policy level at the Washington state level. It's just as alcohol prohibition fell before with states pulling out of this. That's what Roger Goodman's group is trying to recognize, the inherent amount of violence and problems to our youth that are caused by these policies. And so I'm really happy to say that we're part of that. So I speak on that note. As a medical student, I have the great honor of meeting people, working with doctors in Seattle, like Dr. Gregory Carter, who's a professor of physical and rehabilitation medicine in Seattle at the University of Washington. He has totally been a great mentor for me and led the way. He has written a paper, Rational Guidelines for Dosing, which is used in court cases to help judges and lawyers understand what exactly how cannabis can be used medicinally. He has I've had an opportunity to see patients with him in the clinic and to actually see firsthand exactly what a cannabis recommendation, how that happens, how it helps patients' health related quality of life. I mean, it's remarkable. So I totally stand on the backs of all these great people like Dr. Carter. As a student, as a student, I should say that if there's any students out here or listening at home on their radios, they should know that anytime you have an opportunity to do a research topic or pick a paper topic to write on, this is a great way to raise the issue by talking about a cannabis-related issue in your work. That's something that I've tried to do with my PhD is to dig deeply into the cannabis and cannabis-related issues and start to look at it as actually a part of our environment. I think this is with my work with Washington PSR, I've learned that you can actually connect cannabis issues to the environment. It's another plant, just like we protect our rivers and our streams and things like that. This is a part of our environment, and we have to make peace with it. So I recommend all students out there to pick research topics like that and to educate your own classmates on these types of issues. I have to say that it's been a really difficult process for me to come out of the closet to talk about these issues, and if it wasn't folks like this and Mickey Norris and Chris Conrad's website, cannabisconsumers.org, I wouldn't have never really felt the courage to do this. But there's a message that keeps ringing in my mind, which is leverage your privilege. It doesn't exactly rhyme, but I don't know what it's there for if not to to make a change. And the more of us that stand up, recognize that we are given or handed certain privileges in our society, the more we can realize this is a complete farce. As a person in medicine, I feel that doctors and physicians have really shirked a lot of their responsibility on this issue. I mean, when we had it in our formulary in the United States from mid-1840s to 1941, cannabis as a medicine, there was multiple pages of indications. And that completely, all of a sudden, those indications don't exist anymore. Did the plant's genetics change? Did its mechanism of action change? Did people just stop responding to it? I mean, why would we all of a sudden become mum about it? And that's, I think that there's been a complete shirking of our recognition on that point. We should call it for what it is. It is a medicinal plant, a legitimate medicinal plant, or what the FDA would call a botanical medicine. We understand these things. These aren't crazy, far out concepts. This is stuff that we're using in medicine today, and we have for a long time. And I think doctors and physicians need to, kind of cut through that, and recognize it for what it is. Given the climate that we have, a situation where the doctors cannot, in the 11 states where it's allowed in this country, they can recommend it, but it can't be around it. How many medicines have you ever seen where the doctor is not allowed to touch the medicine to give to the patient? How are we supposed to administer it? It's completely the most insane idea. When you have the WHO has recognized cannabis as a medicine, several countries around the world have recognized it as a medicine. What I call this is as American federal denialism of cannabis as a medicine. And then certainly we've been talking about moral issues. There's something called moralism. And I think that moralism is also part of our definitions of mental disorders. Cannabis abuse, marijuana abuse that Vivian talked about, there's actually, if you look in the DSM, I'm going to be talking about this tomorrow on a panel. There's an incredible amount of moralism that goes on if you read people's understanding of what it means to have a cannabis abuse disorder. The idea there is you must be completely crazy to use cannabis because it's illegal. Or you must be on your way to becoming crazy. When I say crazy, I mean mentally disordered. And these aren't things that we should throw around lightly. Mental disorders have been thrown around for a long time. And as everyone knows, homosexuality was in the DSM till 1973. And you know, I was just reading a little history of Seattle. People were lobotomized in the psychiatric institutions in Washington State. Because they were had an antisocial personality disturbance. That's how homosexuality was understood. And I feel really happy talking about that here in San Francisco, which has completely been a bastion of safety on these issues. And I think in the same way. Okay, sure. All right. Well, that's part of the moralism that I want to actually try to address as well in my work. And I guess to wrap up, I'll just say it's a complete honor to be on this panel with these folks, and I hope to I hope for a future that where cannabis mythology and cannabophobia is completely eradicated. Thank you very much.
I like the word cannophobia. You all will be happy to know that my frontal lobe is still intact. They didn't get me, at least not yet. When we talk about people who can walk in different circles, I think our next panelist is a fantastic example of someone who has dealt hands-on with people who really have been affected negatively by these laws. When I was at the Normal Conference in 2001, it was over 420 in Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, in the other Washington, there was a rally, and it was focused around Rene Boget and other people affected by marijuana laws in U.S. and North America. And this next panelist showed up wearing interesting clothing, I was told, very colorful, cultural. And in the course of her speech, managed to transform from the image of someone who appears to be primarily aligned with the counterculture to someone who was aligned with mainstream culture. And she indeed has dealt with people from all walks of life and exhibits really the importance of being able to do so. For the past 11 years, she focused her private criminal defense practice on defending the rights and property of individuals accused of committing drug offenses. She is the Vice President West of the Washington Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, a past chair of the Legal Frameworks Committee for the King County Bar Association's Drug Policy Project. And she is also on the Marijuana Policy Review Panel, which oversees marijuana enforcement in the city of Seattle. Just this week, on Monday, in fact, she began her new phase of her career, joining the ACLU of Washington on the Marijuana Education Project as its director. She is really got quite a bit of conviction to stop convictions. Please welcome Allison Chin Holcomb.
Being introduced by Dominic is both a blessing and a curse. He gives the most wonderful introductions, but then you have to follow them. In 1996, I was the lawyer who represented Martin Martinez on his first trial for medical marijuana use. And this was the first time in my life that I had ever defended a medical marijuana patient. It was also the first medical marijuana case that had been brought in King County, and it predated Washington's medical marijuana law. The things that I remember the most about representing Martin are Martin and his experiences and the time that he sat with me talking about his motorcycle accident and the ungodly amounts of morphine that were pumped through his system for the months that he was in hospital care, and how he was able to use marijuana to go on through literally bone-crushing injuries, damage to his optical nerve, calcification of all of his joints that limited his mobility, and become a carpenter again, building and remodeling people's homes while using medical marijuana. It was what he needed to control his pain and to have a normal life again and not to give up any reason for living. That was a very powerful moment in my life. The trial lasted for 2 weeks. Martin may remember at one point we had to take a break because as I was cross-examining the DEA agent who was testifying about the anticipated yield from Martin's garden, I challenged the basis of the data for the yield that he was describing Martin's grow being able to produce, and referenced what some of you may know about as the outdoor grows that were used in Texas by the government to establish what a plant could yield, and of course have these figures that balloon enormously. We had to take a break because the DEA agent got uncomfortable and had to call back to Washington, D.C. to see if he could answer my questions from this public document. It was kind of odd. And the last thing that was very interesting about the case is the verdict was actually, it's not a verdict, it was a mistrial. The jury hung. And as I talked to a number of the jurors after the trial, I learned that originally in the deliberations, the vote had broken down 9-3. There were 8 women on the jury and 4 men. One man was on the side of the women to acquit Martin. And after enough time had gone by and he had been browbeaten by his male counterparts on the jury, he changed his vote, and ultimately the jury hung 8 women to acquit and 4 men to convict. I think there's a lesson there for us. I think there's a lesson, too, in the reasons that were given, that the women said, I looked at him, and as a mother or a grandmother or a sister, I could not see how we could justify denying this to this man who was able to live his life specifically because he used medical marijuana. And that was the instinct that was used by those women to justify the conclusions that they reached. The men, on the other hand, talked about not being able to quantify pain, not being able to see a systematic way of measuring exactly what it was that Martin was experiencing, and that's why they just couldn't really understand that medical marijuana was actually working in a scientific way. I wonder, though, if really what we saw happening here was the embodiment of George Lakoff's discussion of framing and how the conservatives have created very successfully a paternalistic father figure strict approach to what we can and can't do versus more nurturing model of parents where we care for other people and try to help them be better. And it, for me, just now finally getting around to reading Mr. Lakoff's book, it has really resonated with me in the experiences that I've had in reviewing the cases and what I hear out of the mouths of the people that I deal with on my cases. In 2002, I had another medical marijuana case. In this case, it was after the Washington State Medical Marijuana Act had passed, and I was representing a couple. The wife was a patient, and the husband was her designated caregiver and was providing medical marijuana for her. She, in turn, was a designated caregiver for another gentleman, older gentleman, who had very severe intestinal problems and was actually terminally ill. And she had managed, with the medical marijuana that she was providing him, to extend his life by several years. They were raided a little bit before 6 a.m. the WestNet, which is one of the cool acronyms that our interagency law enforcement agencies use. WestNet team came in black riot gear and used a battering ram to take down the door of their trailer home. My two clients ran out of their rooms and, of course, were ordered down with bright flashlights and semi-automatic rifles to their faces. Before they were able to get down onto their faces, though, their teenage son ran out of his bedroom, of course, alarmed at what was going on and worried for his parents. His parents had to watch as their son had a gun put to his forehead and ordered down to the floor. I myself have no children. 4 years and it doesn't go away. Sorry. I myself have no children, but I cannot imagine what it would be like. And I still can't. They had to stand by, inert and helpless, while they watched their son and feared, because their son, of course, being the brave son that he was, actually challenged these people, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" And they were very worried that he was going to be shot and killed, as so many of us have heard of other people being shot and killed or their dogs being shot and killed in the midst of a raid. And they had to do nothing but get down on their knees and put their faces on the floor. We mounted a medical marijuana defense on their behalf. They were charged by the state of Washington. The wife, the woman in the partnership, had done extensive research on her own without consulting with a lawyer to try to determine how to comply with the Washington State Medical Marijuana Act, which is definitely not an easy thing to figure out. But she had done admirable work, and we felt very confident that we had a compelling case for the jury. Apparently, the county prosecutor agreed with us and referred the case to the United States Attorney for the Western District of Washington, knowing full well that there is no federal medical marijuana defense and that they could just go down on federal crimes. Given the number of plants at issue, they were, of course, looking at a 5-year mandatory minimum. Under the Washington law, even if they had been convicted, they would have at the time been looking at 1 to 3 months in jail. And, of course, we intended to win with our medical marijuana defense. What we had to do in that case was we had to give up the medical marijuana defense in exchange for the U.S. attorney agreeing to refer the case back to the state so that we could walk into a state courtroom, not assert any medical marijuana defense, and plead guilty to felonies. 2 days before their sentencing hearing, the patient that the wife had been providing for died because, of course, he had been denied his medical marijuana from the time of their arrest. I was born in Fort Smith, Arkansas. I was raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I went to a public high school. I went to college in the Bay Area here, then went to law school in Washington. My father and stepmother still live in Tulsa. My brother lives in Los Angeles. My mother lives in Las Vegas, used to live in New York City for 14 years with my stepfather. And I have a stepbrother in Ohio and a stepsister in Missouri. My father is a Republican. My stepmother, I believe, registers as a Republican, but I received a really funny message from her yesterday. She didn't know at the time that I was here, and she left me a message saying, "I just wanted you to know that tomorrow is marijuana day. And I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of that." And I thought that was pretty fantastic. My mother and stepfather, on the other hand, are very active Democratic activists in Las Vegas. Why do I share all this autobiographical information? It's important for you and I to get to know one another. It's important for me to get to know what motivates you. What's your life experience? I have not had the same life experiences that you have had, and you have not had the same life experiences that I have had. I have spent many, many hours, days, months, years talking to prosecutors and police officers and judges. And I have also spent a great deal of time talking to grassroots members. I've talked to hundreds and hundreds of clients. And I have things that I can share with you, and you have things that I can that you can share with me, that you need to share with me. The conservative movement has been waging an incredibly successful campaign for the last 40 years to marginalize marijuana, to marginalize marijuana users, to make marijuana users look like kooks, freaks, lazy people, and we've heard it time and time again, and it's absolutely true, immoral. It's an immoral decision to use marijuana. The success of that campaign makes it incredibly difficult for people like me and the judges and prosecutors that I talk to about marijuana and the doctors and nurses and librarians and professors and all of these different people from different walks of life that come to the King County Bar Association meetings, that come and attend the Marijuana Policy Review Panel meetings, that I see in the course of my everyday life when I'm wearing my suit and looking mainstream. It's tough for me to be able to talk to them comfortably and credibly about why they should speak out about what they really believe about marijuana, because the conservative prohibitionist, you would think I could pronounce that word by now, prohibitionist movement has been so successful for the last 40 years. Vivian touched on something that just struck me in the heart. He's so right that, yes, we have the grass tops wants to be able to create a mainstream message and get that mainstream message out so that we can successfully roll back the damage of the last 40 years. But at the same time, we can't lose the heart and the soul. That's what got me here, is talking to the people who were the heart and the soul of why I'm doing what I'm doing. We are missing the middle part. We're missing the stalk. We're missing the strongest part of the cannabis plant. We're missing the part that makes the strongest ropes, the best paper, fabulous clothing. We're missing the connection and the communication between the grass tops and the grassroots. And it is for that reason that I am so thrilled and honored to be here. This is my first normal conference. I've been to the normal, thank you, I'm very excited. I've been to the normal, the continuing legal education seminars in Key West. I've been to those and I'll be there again this year. But this is the first time that I've gotten to be present at a normal conference and see more of the grassroots people and to be doubly blessed and asked to speak on a panel and to have your attention and patience as I share with you my experiences. I'm looking forward to hearing from yours and I'm really looking forward to figuring out how we're going to talk better with one another, strategize better with one another, and win. Thank you.
Two Okies from Muskogee on one panel. Imagine, now we, Tulsa, okay. Now we know where everyone from Oklahoma goes. They head to San Francisco and Seattle. So it's easy when you are in a city and it's a progressive city, and people want to get together, they want to talk about progressive issues, they want to talk about reform. But there's a question of how do you go beyond the city? How do you go to the suburbs? How do you go to the rural areas? You really need a messenger, someone to take this out who can speak on the same terms as the people, the grass tops of those communities that really don't identify as being part of a marijuana reform movement. Our next speaker has done a fantastic job at doing just that, and he is director of the Drug Policy Project at the King County Bar Association. He has a resume longer than the rap sheet of an entire cell block, so I won't be able to read it all to you in the interest of time. But I will say that he serves on the American Bar Association Standing Committee on Substance Abuse.